Hello, welcome to a new episode of Over Morrow's Library, a podcast series from the Center of Contemporary Arts in Geneva. Today, we have with us Professor Giulio Busi from the Freie Universität of Berlin, where he directs the Institute of Jewish Studies, but he also is the author of Heavenly Palaces in Judaism, the book which we explored in our previous episode. Professor Busi, thank you for coming on our podcast.
Thank you to you.
I would like to start where we left it in our previous episode, the literature on the heavenly palaces, the Echalot. In your book, you discuss this tradition whose origin can be traced back to the area of Mesopotamia. It's very interesting that you point out the relationship between this tradition and other mystical traditions in the same region, but also you look at similar forms of mystical heavenly journeys as far as East Asia. So could you please explain to us to what extent this form of mysticism is peculiar to Judaism and to what extent it shares elements with other traditions?
Yeah, this is an open problem, I think. It's not solved yet. And I would say it has been explored very little so far. So I'm studying Jewish mysticism since something like 30 years. And I know the mystical literature of the palaces, the so-called palaces, Echalot. And I know the usual approach in this field, the scholarly approach, that is to normally to study this tradition, the text, the literature within the border, within the area of Jewish studies. So it's in Hebrew. It's Jewish in the sense that the quotation from the Bible are there, the names of the rabbis are there. So it's a kind of self-containing stuff. And I don't agree with this kind of, maybe it's my approach, my vision, my background. Usually I try to cross borders and to look around for parallels. And not because I think that parallels are the solution, but mysticism and magic, because this kind of literature is in between magic and mysticism, is very much linked also to practical skills and magical skills. The magical tradition and part of the mystical tradition is cross-cultural. It's not usually linked to just a single culture, but has patterns that are broader and they are deeply linked with the other cultures. So my problem was with the Echalot literature, the fact that the mystical narrative concerns seven palaces. So the mystical goes through seven palaces, and at the end of these seven palaces meets God or an empty throne that represents the higher level of the Godhead. The problem is that in the Jewish tradition and in the Bible, obviously you have a single temple, not seven temples, not seven palaces. And my question is, why seven? And why this number is so important? Why this structure of the heavens is organized according to this pattern? And concerning this point, it comes immediately the parallel with the Mesopotamian tradition, with the seven heavens of the Mesopotamian tradition, with the magical literature concerning these seven levels of the heavenly structure. So this remains in the background in the Jewish text, in the Hebrew text, but it's essential from a symbolical point of view. I mean, I think that we have fragments of a cultural heritage in Hebrew. We have other fragments in the Sabian literature, that is a Mesopotamian, broadly speaking. We have fragments of this magical and mystical tradition in the Sufi heritage. We can find out something similar even in Burma, in China as well. So it's a scattered heritage. In no one of these traditions you have the full picture. But if you put together the different literatures, then maybe you achieve a sharper view, a sharper picture. I'm a philologist, and I know that usually you should have historical proofs and historical links. So from an historical point of view, I'm not able to say this element was taken from the Jews exactly at a certain historical point in a certain historical context. But I'm able to achieve a symbolical pattern. So when you have a structure of seven heavens, and these seven heavens and seven palaces are crucial for understanding a text, and you have this structure in Hebrew and a similar structure in Arabic in the Sufic literature, something similar in the Chinese tradition, then you can achieve, at least from a symbolic point of view, a kind of putting together all this evidence and getting a sharper picture. Why Mesopotamian? Because Mesopotamian works like a kind of melting pot of very ancient magical and mystical tradition.
One thing that struck me when reading your book was the figure of the angel. Angels in Judaism seem to be quite hostile to the humans, perhaps with only one exception, the archangel Metatron, who himself is a migrant into heaven, being of human origin. So could you please tell us a bit more about this hostility of the angels towards the humans? What does it mean?
Yeah, the angels, they play mostly a negative role. I think this is typical, not only of the Jewish tradition, also in the Gnosticism, you have something similar. There's a kind of war between the mystical that is trying to reach the heaven and this kind of guardians of the heaven. They do not want any human visitor, let's say, to their sphere. And one of the main goals of the mystic is to try to pass and to appease these guardians, and he must know the right words and the right way, and they must have the right seals to show to them in order to get the entrance to the different gates. So these angels are not, so to say, general figures of the heaven. They are guardians, usual guardians that prevent heavenly travelers from entering these many gates one after the other that fill the heavens and the palaces. So I think that the attitude, the negative attitude to the guardians depends also on a negative function in the narrative. The narrative demands this kind of opposition between the human sphere and somebody who is put in between God and humans. There's the sphere of the angels that plays a kind of role in the narrative itself.
We have been talking about Echalot literature, but perhaps the most famous strand of Jewish mysticism is Kabbalism. So, as I briefly mentioned in our previous episode, this tradition first emerged in the region between Catalonia and south of France around the 12th century. What is interesting is that it's central to Kabbalism is the interpretation of the sacred texts, and especially the Torah. So could you please tell us a bit more about how Kabbalism suggests to read sacred texts?
Yeah, there's a passage in the Torah that says that it's like a dream. So the Torah is like a dream that must be interpreted, must be analyzed, must be solved. It's a riddle that must be solved. And this could be a good way to define the whole business, let's say, of the Kabbalah, of especially of the Zohar, you have a kind of mysterious text. You have the holy text. And the entrance to the text is the common way to read and to understand the holy text. And this is very, very important. It remains the entrance. So the literary level of the meaning is crucial. And this is very Jewish. So in the sense that the further levels of meaning, what we could say, we could define according to a Christian definition, a Western definition, the allegorical level of the text, they come after the first one. They must be discovered, and they are potentially already there. Everything is in the Bible. The 70 phases or 72 phases of the Bible, about which the Kabbalah is always discussing and always assuming that they are there, are potentially hidden in the text, already existent. The only problem, like the meaning in a dream, the only problem is to discover them and to express them. For this purpose, the whole system of the Kabbalah has been developed. There are hermeneutical tools that are employed from different perspectives in order to find out one after the other the deeper and the mystical meanings of the Torah.
And this leads me to a question that is a bit lateral to what we have discussed so far, but it's because of part of your work is dedicated to art. And this sounds a bit little strange if we consider that your primary field of research is mysticism, so the exploration of what is invisible. I was wondering, in what way can art enter this investigation of the invisible and of the unthinkable, and how it can be of assistance?
You are right. At the university, I teach Jewish studies, but in between, there's also the life. So I ran an art gallery when I was younger. And I've been always interested in art. I've written a biography of Michelangelo, for instance. And I feel really at home. It's my second home, let's say. The visual dimension. Also, it exists, the visual dimension of Jewish mysticism. I wrote a book in Italian, and I think I invented the definition of visual Kabbalah that previously didn't exist. I wrote the book some 15 years ago in Italian. It is called Kabbalah Visiva. It exists also a visual dimension in the Kabbalah that has been, I think, ignored mainly and not really understood by Sholem and his followers and his students. I try also to explain why, because of the Sholem was very much influenced by German idealistic philosophy, and according to this perspective, this visual expression were not very much important. What was important was the theory expressed by the Kabbalists. But when you look at the manuscript of the Kabbalists, I discovered this studying the manuscript in libraries. Then there are a lot of diagrams of drawings and visual and images, abstract images, but images. And they are essential in order to understand the invisible. This is the problem. If you study the world of the Sefirot, the Godhead, it's so complex, it's so difficult to grasp that you need a kind of visual background, maybe very simple from an artistic point of view, but visual. And I discovered something that I never read in the books by Sholem, for instance, that the Kabbalists themselves they used a lot this kind of stuff in order to study the Kabbalah. One thing is that if you read a scholarly book in order to understand when, why, and how it's philosophically or theologically, how the Kabbalah works. But if you want to be a Kabbalist and to really grasp this kind of inner dimension of the Sefirot, then you need to visualize them somehow. And this is what is happening in the manuscript especially. And nowadays, after my book, there's very good scholars in Israel especially. They are studying this kind of Kabbalistic parchments and diagrams and bringing the visual also in the field of the invisible, or if you want, the invisible to the field of the visual.
And talking of discoveries, I first discovered your work while studying the humanist thinker Pico della Mirandola. You have written very beautifully and very acutely on the relationship between Pico della Mirandola and Jewish mysticism, especially the Kabbalah. And this is an aspect of the Renaissance which is often overlooked. So can you please tell us a bit more, to what extent the thinkers of Renaissance humanism are indebted to Jewish mysticism?
Yeah, this is a very fascinating question. I think that Pico, not only myself, is well known that Pico is the first one in 1486 to bring a large extent of Kabbalistic ideas to the very crucial focus of humanistic culture. Before Pico, we could say that humanist in Italy and also outside Italy cared too much for, in fact, they did ignore the old Jewish mystical lore. They were not interested in it. There were humanists at the beginning of the 15th century who studied Hebrew and who studied scientific texts, but the Kabbalah, the mystical stuff, was ignored. With Pico, who collected a larger number of manuscripts and let convert to Christianity, Flavius Mithridates, let translate this kind of literature from Hebrew into Latin. With Pico begins this Christian Kabbalah in the sense that Pico wanted to try to Christianize the Jewish mystical lore. And he was convinced that the Jews didn't understand fully what they studied and what they produced. If one could understand properly this kind of Jewish text, then he would understand also that Christianity was the true religion and the Christ was the true Messiah. This was the Christianizing attitude by Pico that can be obviously criticized, must be criticized. But nevertheless, notwithstanding these Christianized goals and approach, Pico gave to this heritage a great importance and brought the literature, and what is more important, the method of this literature, the way of studying through Sefirot and through linguistic tools, the Hebrew text of the Torah, brought it to the center of, to the focus of the scholarly attention of the humanist. After Pico, we have Johannes Reuchlin in Germany. We have a lot of father humanists, or later humanists, that are excited about Jewish stuff, and especially excited about the great extent of linguistic and theological possibilities of Kabbalistic hermeneutics.
Your latest book is titled Guessing the World, The 100 Doors of Destiny, and it's dedicated to the practice of divination. In our society, which is focused on the idea of freedom, the notion of destiny seems to have fallen out of fashion, or maybe it's often invoked in very simplified forms. What can we understand by the term destiny, and in what way is it knowable through our human means?
So my first answer is, I don't know. This is the beginning of the book. I don't know. And I do not try to give answers. I'm just collecting stories, narratives from the ancient Mesopotamian to today. I collected a lot of stories told by friends and by acquaintances. Something is happening, not always, but sometimes in our life, and this happens also in the tradition and in the literature, we feel that we are close to a situation, we experience a situation that sounds like future, that sounds like a premonition, sounds like something that maybe we are going to experience. Very often it's just a wrong impression, but I'm very interested in the very few experiences and premonition and divination that really later on happens. It's by chance, it's a mistake, or we can enter a gate, a door, and discover something, maybe not about the future, but something about ourselves. What is happening? Where? Why? This is a very interesting question for me. I'm a very rational. I have a very rational approach. I'm a philologist, and if I don't see the source, the Quelle in German, I'm not able to write my text. I need a source. I need to be able to touch it. But I have to admit, and the people around me also experience it, that there are sources also about the future. There are experiences of the future. There are places in our mind where past, future, present are mixed. And this is very fascinating to me. And I think it's a pity. It's a pity just to discard it and to ignore it, because it makes us feel weaker and feel a bit confused. We lose something if we ignore these places in our mind, this sensation in our life where times collapse and get confused and get together. It's a very deep human feeling, and I try to look around and at least to collect stories about it.
And to conclude, one last question, which is, to be honest, rather a request for advice. As you know, this podcast wishes to create an imaginary library for the day after tomorrow. So we want to present books and authors that might help us to approach the problem of making world and the experience of worlds disintegrating. So could you please suggest a few titles, or just even one, that we should include on the shelves of our library?
There are many, obviously. One good possibility, one good source of inspiration for myself are the dreams by Franz Kafka. There are a few of them, terrible or beautiful or both, in his work. Even in letters, he retells the dreams, and often he begins the dream and then it's not completed. He doesn't bring the dream to an end, like dreams. And this is like normal dreams are not not complete. I think Kafka, obviously, I'm not the only one, is always great, is incredibly modern. His fragments are even deeper. And his dreams are, to my mind, the best in his work. A further suggestion, something that I found very important for my intellectual search for meaning, is Paul Celan, The Meridian. The speech he gave on the 22nd of October, 1960. And I was born something like a month before. I was too young at that time. I discovered Paul Celan 30 years ago. But in some respect, I feel this speech that is a crucial reflection on poetry after Auschwitz, like for myself, a kind of biographical background, something that I feel, I do not come from a Jewish family, but I've studied a lot of Jewish culture. I do not have a direct experience of Holocaust, of Shoah, but I think that I have a kind of feeling that what Paul Celan is trying to say in this speech concerns myself and all the Western civilization, if we can use the word civilization, after Auschwitz.
Thank you, Professor Buzzi, for having been with us today. It's been a privilege. And thank you to our listeners. And I hope also that you will follow us to our next episode of Overmorrow's Library, still here from the Center of Contemporary Arts in Geneva. Goodbye.